discussion on where do we go from here. So if you have, it's a very loose topic. We can talk about many, many things. But if there are any topics in particular or questions you would like to address, please either email me at glander@scripps.edu or just fill out one of the note cards in the back that I think Lorraine has. Right. Should be an interesting discussion. I'm not chairing the session, though.
All right, so good morning, everybody. We're going to have a session this morning to start with on validation. And obviously, validation is something that has been in our mind, in our field for a long time. We've all seen the famous faces coming out of the noise of either Albert Einstein or David de Rozier. And that has put fear in many of us and actually made people out of our community conscious of that, of the fact that we work with noisy images and that issues can happen. So validation is very important, has always been, is even more so now that the field has really become mainstream and there's a lot of people incoming into it. And we have to somehow settle down or have an agreement on the of a number of validation tools that can be very generally applicable and that we can expect at the time of publication of papers, etc. So we'll hear about some of this today. Validation can happen at any stage. You want to validate your data. You definitely want to validate your reconstruction. And we are now facing more often the problem, inverted commas, of having to validate atomic models, which is a good place to be. But it is also important, and the tools that we use have to be distinct from those of crystallographers because of the nature of our distinct data. So I don't want to take any more time from the speakers. We are going to start with Peter Rosenthal, which I believe is going to concentrate more on the validation of the structures. We're going to end with Frank Di Maio, which is going to concentrate more on creation and validation of atomic models. And in the middle, we'll have Paul Penchek, which is going to talk about validation of everything. So we'll see what he has to say. So Peter.
Like stars, there are billion and billion. Oh, what happened? Sorry? This is active, I assume. You can hear me.
Let's do the other.
Yeah.
Okay. And you can walk away.
Yep.
Test.
Okay, I want to thank the organizers for inviting me to this wonderful location where actually it's harder to think about map validation than where I'm coming from. And I'd say Richard Henderson often gives a lecture on this subject, but I think he got a job that paid $4 an hour more. And okay. So there's some data. And here's a picture of two people. You can just see in their faces that they're absolutely in love with their model. And it is probably true that there are some models that are so beautiful and so powerful an explanation that they must be correct. And I think one should note that they also made use of that data set in the first slide, which they assumed was publicly available. Yeah, it is possible that you might also come up with another model to try and explain the same object. And this was Linus Pauling's incorrect model. And, oh, actually, the could somebody... no, anyway, it's okay, but from here I'm seeing a magnification anisotropy. I don't know if that's... okay. This was an incorrect model, and, of course, it was immediately recognized as incorrect because of the... problems of the phosphates on the inside. So there were chemical reasons for rejecting such a model. So these are the questions that have been assigned for this session. Some of them, as Eva described, validation methods are now out there, and we'll talk about what are some of these methods, and we'll have discussions about all of those. What resolution ranges, do we need more tools, how do we avoid mistakes, and Is it an easier job at low or at high resolution? And at the end of this week of discussion so far, I'm not sure. And then the interesting question about heterogeneity. So the validation problem is divided into maps and models is one way of thinking of it. Possibly they can be combined in one big calculation in the future. I'll be focusing more on this, and I think at least one of the subsequent speakers about model validation. And validation is supposed to be something that we don't fear because it can actually help us solve our problems and possibly get to higher resolution. And related to the issue of validation is how do we communicate those validation results to a community so that others can check that the results are correct and allow them to also investigate what the data means. And so, and there's a lot of activities driven by the databases, as we'll hear a little bit at the end of the talk. Okay. Now, in some sense, all of this was a very unglamorous activity until, and I think any coincidence, this is purely coincidental, is that I guess a structure appeared with extravagant claims, which I think everybody assumed to be physically impossible. It's interesting that a lot of the discussions at this meeting suggest that that such molecules can be solved in that sort of resolution. So the initial notion that it was impossible, was probably wrong. But then it becomes, what are the particulars of the study? So the summary of what I'll discuss is that is how do we figure out if a map is correct, or is it all that we can say is that maybe that it's incorrect at low resolution, and that'll be about tilt pairs for both optimizing orientation determination and validation. Then we'll get into the thorny subject of is the resolution assessment exaggerated? But the focus will be on the simple tests that are now available to demonstrate the validity of the map. Users can still process their data the way they want, but by taking a few extra steps, they might be able to satisfy the concerns of others. So here's the general problem. We have particle images. We have to propose a starting model that explains the images. I agree, this is an easier case than some I've seen this week, and then to take that model to higher resolution by bringing it into agreement with the image data. And I think as far as though there are many different ways to determine a starting map, I think most people agree that the map projections should agree with individual raw images in their appearance, and also with class averages, hopefully obtained in some reference sort of way and therefore not biased. And we also hope that there is a wide range of views of the particle so that one is not just simply explaining one view. I think absolute hand is also something that one has to, one can verify experimentally, particularly for low resolution structures, and that of course requires tilting experiments. Now, there are other sources for creating a map, for refining a map other than a de novo calculation, and that is one can derive it from another highly similar structure, which I think we see in the literature all the time, and that's a discussion point of whether that is a good thing to do. We can take a density from an X-ray model and low-pass filter it and try to bring that into agreement with the data, and often features can emerge that are suggestive that that the structure determination is correct. Yeah, or can we begin with multiple starts of a spherical blob or a cylindrical structure in the case of helices and by multiple starts converge on a structure? And is that a justification that the structure is correct? So in more detail, the particles have to be signed their orientation parameters, microscope parameters. The starting model is used to determine the orientations, and a new model is produced, and there has to be some agreement between the model projections and the images. And in that iterative process, one can bring a map to higher resolution, and of course using different possible measures of agreement between the projections and the images. Related to that case I mentioned in the earlier slide, which is the one that generated a lot of discussion, and this is from Marin van Hill's commentary on that, which is the familiar case of showing that if the images are pure noise, we can take a glycoprotein trimer and generate nice classes from it, and we can also do the same thing with Einstein or David Derozier for the same sets of data. Now, I guess in recent years there's probably been a lot of progress on addressing this problem. This is a paper that's been mentioned earlier in the week. The idea that there are ways to do your refinement which are less susceptible to getting stuck with an incorrect starting model. And in this case, it's from Fred Sigworth's model calculations comparing a maximum likelihood, which somehow can avoid the bias of the initial reference compared to simply using cross-correlation. So the problem, and this is from Henderson's commentary on this, on the same structure determination, is that when the authors provided individual images, it really looked like there was nothing there. And of course, we have grown to get used to the idea that cryo images are low contrast, and that it is a project to fish the information out of those images. But the contention here was that there were no particles in this image. And I think this was a known difficult structure. But anyway, I think the Einstein out of the noise problem does make one worry and need to be cautious. So in particular, one should not put on blinders and ignore this problem, and one really must lose sleep over worrying about whether your structure determination is correct. For those in the home audience, I haven't included this picture to protect the scientist. And in fairness, he got on the plane from an earlier time zone, and I'm pretty sure he knew his maps were valid before he went to sleep. So in contrast to those very noisy images, here again from that same commentary are pictures of beta-galactosidase taken with a very large dose and a large defocus. And for there, it's pretty clear that that there are particles there, and they look like the object that comes out at the end. So this is sort of the zeroth step in structure validation, that there are particles there. Now, of course, how one goes about picking those particles can be a big part of the issue. If it's if they're picked by a template, obviously, then you can fish out what you would like out of noise. Whereas, and I thought I would pick this whole film for you while I was here. Okay. Yeah. All right. Maybe. Okay, so then the question is, what are some of the easy tests that we can do to make sure that we haven't been that we haven't taken a wrong model into detailed agreement with the data? And this describes the a tilt pair experiment, which is easier to do than, let's say, making this figure. Okay. So in the first image, you can see these particles, and we've simply rotated the specimen holder and recorded those same images at a tilt angle alpha of the goniometer. And there are our two particle stacks, and given our starting model, we can make matching projections against those for both the untilted and the tilted, and then there's obviously a orientation of the model, which is giving rise to each of those projections. So if we are simply fitting noise in both image stacks, then there shouldn't be any relationship between those orientation angles. But if you're fitting signal in those images, then those particles should be related by the known tilt angle and tilt axis of the experiment, which we know very well. So this is this familiar tilt diff plot, where from the untilted and tilted orientations, you can calculate the tilt axis in the plane for each particle pair. So each of those points corresponds to one of 50 particles in a single micrograph. So for perfect data, all of those points should coincide. I should say that these plots are an angle alpha, and the distance from the origin is the angle alpha, and the direction of the vector is the direction of the tilt axis in the plane. So, of course, from this particle field, it's very hard to guess what the tilt axis is. One might be able to fish it out of there, but the hope is one might do better. So there's another form of the tilt analysis where we determine orientations for the first particle stack, and then from those orientations, we apply all possible tilt axes to get predicted orientations, which we can score against the tilted image stack. And again, you can use various scores for that agreement. And for each of these tilt operators, we will get a landscape, and then we can average all the particles that are supposed to share that same operation. And this was an example where the tilt angle was supposed to be about 10 degrees known from the experiment, but in fact the tilt angle only came out to be about 7 degrees. So there was obviously, it was, some approximate agreement, but not in detail. We also found it was always useful to look at what the depth of the minimum in the plot was compared to a point elsewhere in the plot, which would be where we would expect the minimum to be for that same model, but one with an opposite hand, so that you would rotate the opposite-handed model by the opposite angle. So we would compare those two points. So both the position of the minimum in the phase residual plot, as well as the difference between the way it distinguished the handedness, seemed to be a way to test all of the procedures that one was using that would lead to these orientations. So that could be any detail of the search procedure. It could reflect model quality, resolution ranges, anything else. And in particular, for the example of resolution range, if we cut our data off at 35 angstroms, then we had a minimum, but it wasn't quite where we wanted to be. If we made a modest increase in the resolution range used to assign the data, then we were much closer to 10 degrees, and there was a greater distinguishing of one hand from the other. So after that sort of optimization, One had what looked like a healthier plot, and then if one then applies that original test where you separately determine the orientations for one stack and the other and find what the tilt transformation is. Now, after that optimization, things were much more convincing that all the data from that given film were clustered at the correct tilt angle. So this sort of tilt plot seems to be the one that everyone is showing, and I think it is very simple illustration. One argument initially was that you would have to expose your image twice, which was something that single particle people didn't want to do. Tomography people seem to have no trouble with that. But there's no question that the second film will have some radiation damage, and then the orientation determination might be less reliable. Of course, in the new era of absolutely fantastic data, I think that one should be able to extract many different, certainly more than one view of the of a given particle. Although I did notice something to the contrary this week, which is I realize everyone is just going to want to take as many frames of this and then determine the optimum image from that one once it's fried. So anyway, so I think tilt pairs may still have some resistance for that reason. Anyway, so for this other form of tilt analysis, you only have to determine the orientations at high resolution for the untilted image, and then you can do this plot it using relatively low resolution data, and it's rather robust against the choice of resolution ranges, so that you're not doing a search over the whole space for the second image, and then here's an individual particle landscape, and those are certainly interesting to look at. And of course, here's the landscape for the entire data set for that film, that is. And the each of these points is determined by the individual minima in those landscapes. So it's another way of getting the same plot. In this case, we find the minimum in the circle around it by the properties of the plot. And Richard was very successful in getting a lot of data sets to look at, and that would be one of the great things if there were a means of tilt pair deposition, which I think will probably be in the works, so that we could learn as much as possible. And from these various cases, which includes the rotavirus double-layered particles from Nico's lab, where the orientation determination was absolutely perfect. This was chicken anemia virus, a little bit worse, and beta-galactosidase at being around 450 kilodaltons is a very convincing plot, but clearly there's a wider spread of data. For the case of an incorrect model, if you were to create one of these plots against the untilted image, that is, if you were to find orientations against an image using an incorrect model and then rotated a small angular distance, you would find there is a minimum there. That's why those orientations were found. But on tilting, there would be absolutely no correlation. But the point is that you can always find a minimum when you go searching. So from this tilt diff plot, and this was a paper Henderson et al. In 2011 with data from all these different sources. All took a bit of work to get all of those cases right by all of the authors, but in the end, the winner was the rotavirus, and We won't go into the details on that, but the fantastic feature of that data was that the particles were so well determined that they could learn all sorts of interesting things about what the particles were doing in the ice. So from the overview of all of that data, we had collectively decided on some criterion at the time that the number of particles at the minimum, or the percentage aligned, was a very good indicator of success. That if you had a simple majority of your particles there, then you know you were explaining some of the large the most common features of your data set. So the very interesting conclusion as well is that the smaller particles have the wider angular error, and the larger particles were very well determined. Some exceptions. This analysis also allowed one to ask, well, what resolution range should I use to Reifne my orientations? Okay. I believe that Pavel was going to talk on this new technique. So by varying these inner and outer limits, one of the interesting observations was that if you increase the high resolution cutoff, it didn't mean that your particle orientations were getting any better. So the conclusion there is that the frequency-limited refinement does not necessarily lead to worse orientations. And then just one last, one more comment. Ardan, Patwardhan, and co-workers have been setting up some a tilt server so that everybody can be comfortable about sending their data there, and there might be some a collection of common ways to do the analysis and score it. So again this question about which has often been asked, which is, well, how do we know that tilt plot is proof that the structure is correct? And I think this is something that occurs all the time in the review process, I gather. One answer on that subject was in John Rubinstein's work on the ATPase, where he did a slightly different form of analysis, where he asked in comparing the orientations on the first image and the second image, how far was that prediction of the tilt axis away from the place you expected it to be. So the angular error increased like that. And the particles for this particular study, had very little angular error. But one interesting thing that he did was he plotted what would be expected for the case of random assignment of particle orientations. Because I think one of the real questions is, if you have failed, then your tilt plot is random, and then how do we know is it random? And then I think he had cases, again from his own work, where this one was not as good, and I think this one was even worse. So did you publish that? Never mind. Okay. Then just recently, there's been an interesting form of analysis introduced by Chris Russo and Laurie Passmore, which is that they observed that these tilt plots could be modeled by a Fisher distribution, which has a concentration parameter kappa, which you know is like describing the half width of a Gaussian. And this is a figure from their paper of this year, which shows the cases of rotavirus and the 70S ribosome and pyruvate dehydrogenase. And there they are, the well-clustered ones and then the slightly worse cases. And so they were able to, using some details that you'll have to ask Lori about or read the paper, find a way to do this analysis. And they were able to define this kappa parameter, so which would be very large for rotavirus, somewhat smaller for this case, which otherwise I would have thought is perfect. But they, I think their recommendation was that one needed a kappa greater than 10 to be convinced. And so to summarize on that, so it is a good way to, the tilt pair analysis generally is a good way to optimize orientation. So that's beginning your validation on at the beginning of your structure determination. So ultimately can be used to assess somebody else's map for agreement with the data and the agreement of the map with images. So does the tilt pair parameter plot match the resolution of the structure determination? I think that's a an important thing to do when evaluating a study. So and I think one of the questions which was asked during the session, I think, yesterday was, do we need to do tilt pairs at high resolution? And I think the answer is yes. I think also in the talk by the beautiful work on the NSF, the question was, if I have another day on the microscope, will I do better? And and this sort of analysis can give you an idea of how much work you will need to do to get to higher resolution. In this prescription, it's a simple experiment of doing one tilt pair could represent the whole data set, provided it's done under the same conditions from which you collect most of the data set. There's an idea that maybe every particle you collect could be tilt validated. And maybe we'll talk about that later. So, negative stain. I think negative stain is beautiful, and we second Thomas on that. But there is a problem in validating those structures, and I know that, example, Tim Grant, I know, has done a number of negative stain structures that are really beautiful, but it's difficult to validate them. And the reason is because there's a flattening of the particle in negative stain, which means that the relationship between the untilted and tilted images don't correspond to the known tilt axis of experiment. Not every negative stain, but it is something which is very common in negative stain. Okay, I suppose if there was any discussion point before I mention this subject that we might never get out of again.
So you show this slide where you had done initially the tilt pair analysis and things look quite scattered, and then you did an optimization.
Yes.
And things magically look really beautiful.
Yes.
And that optimization is not trivial. You know, to break the barrier to make people really do this in a systematic way,
yes,
for all their samples and all their structures, it would be good if there was a more automated way of going through this optimization or some guidelines of what to do or what ranges of parameters to change,
yes,
because right now it is not trivial, and it does seem,
yes,
a barrier for...
Yeah, I agree that, and of course, there are now ways of doing tilt analysis and rely on EMAN, etc., and ways of interchanging between all those things, so I think, integrating input and output from the different programs is something that, that despite all the progress, there can probably be more work on. About this, the particular question about optimization, I think I personally, and maybe others can comment, that if you try to do the separate orientations on the two images, with the second one being worse, I found it's harder than looking at these phase residual landscapes, because in those cases, if you just have a little blip of a minimum, you can find a way to get it to go to the in the right direction. Okay. Oh. All right, John, and then John.
So I have two short questions. First is the distribution of points in a tilt pair parameter plot they'll spread out. Can you make a comment on the magnitude of tilt needed in order to resolve... I should back up and ask my second question first. If you take a structure that's unrelated to your map and you impose a small tilt, the two tilted views of that molecule will be quite similar. And so they'll tend to agree with the same view of the map you're testing against. So let's say you're tilting ribosomes, you're comparing them to a proteasome. Two similar views of a ribosome will match the same view of a proteasome, and so the points will cluster near the origin. How big of a tilt, and any real data will have some finite spread for the tilt pair cluster. Yeah. How big a tilt do you need in order to be confident? And yeah. How does it relate to symmetry?
Yeah. Well, one immediate reaction is that the tilt angle should be large enough to move it away from the origin so that it doesn't look like you're sitting symmetrically on the origin. However, the actual angle does depend a lot upon the particle. And I think you can get an idea by actually just taking your map and rotating it over a wide range of angles for all the different views. That is one of these phase residual plots, just by tilting the even model images, and you'll find out what the landscape looks like. Because there will be some maps, for example, very smooth viruses or apoferritin, which from these plots look almost pathological, but by this sort of analysis, I think one can find a way to do them. But I think that it's function of the diameter, roughness, etc., makes a difference in that regard. John.
So you kind of hinted at this problem already, but clearly the best possible alignment is obtained if you expend all of your dose on one image over hundreds of frames and then properly weight that. And that means that your tilt pairs will always be measuring an alignment that is worse than the alignment you actually have in your data set. I would think that if I had a difficult complex, I'd be very reluctant to save dose that I could be using for alignment in order to do a tilt pair validation, which will give me a worse result than I actually have in my data set.
Yes. So I guess that's one of the reasons it may be sufficient to do just a few for the purpose of validation and learning the parameters you need to do. I think you can make an estimate of what the orientational error is due to the how much worse it is due to the dose. But again, those I think you can do the analysis really at a very low resolution and get the results. So I think still worth saving a few electrons. But your point is.
Peter, but if you save a few electrons for the second tilt, then the orientations of the second tilt are going to be not good, and those are again required to do the measurement.
I guess the one answer probably is that we don't need the highest resolution information to get the orientation correct. It's probably the case that you can get a good enough orientation, possibly the best you can ever do, based upon those resolution analysis. So that's probably the answer to that.
If I had a really good goniometer, I would take three movies of every point in my specimen. I'd take a short movie with no tilt, a longer movie with tilt, and then a long movie with no tilt again. If somebody wants to give me a microscope that can do that quickly, I'd be most grateful. And if we did that, I mean, there are ways to combine the information. So just to plug maximum likelihood, you can You can always just add any information you want into maximum likelihood formulation. And so you could actually, without too much trouble, align pairs of images and get better orientations if you had those kinds of tilt pairs. So if there's an easy way to make a tilt pair quickly, you know, so it doesn't kill the throughput, this would be a wonderful way to go.
All right, Peter, I was wondering when you have a case with very strongly preferred orientations and therefore a reconstruction that might have significant artifacts, is there a chance that the tilt pair analysis actually will not reveal this because in that tilt range you're okay?
Yeah, so I think that that is related to the other validation point, which is that ideally one wants a wide range of particle orientations. I agree that that would pose a problem. I guess in such a case, I would probably do a range of different angles, including starting at untilted angles, I guess is the way I would address it. But it does sound like... that would be a little bit of a problem.
So I'm not sure if you want to comment on this, but on the structure you showed from the Mao structure, in their reply to the commentaries, they actually show a tilt plot, right?
Yes.
So does that mean that their structure is a bit right, or?
So my personal view at looking at that plot is that it isn't convincing. But and I think it doesn't stand up against these randomization tests is my suspicion. But I probably those tests are all now too new and haven't yet been applied to that. Is that yeah? But the point is yeah. So that's exactly the importance of agreeing upon a method for that because we don't it cannot be just a shouting match. That's right.
Yeah. I may be missing something, but your alignments were done at the range of 80 to 25 angstrom or something like that. So all this discussion about going to high-resolution movies and all that jazz is probably something that comes after you actually validated your model to the extent that you could validate it. So you could do your whole analysis, your what we call today an initial model at 15 angstroms, and then you know go to higher resolution. I don't know whether at that point you really need to do the validation by tilt pairs.
Okay. Well, I observed that on one of Shores's first very high resolution ribosome works, he actually applied tilt analysis to figuring out what were the best ways to partition his data for summing. So I think that in the end, it's a readout on orientation analysis. As you push to high resolution, it just becomes more and more important. And I think with the better detector, the hope is that with more precise orientations that we would also see, be able to assay those orientations with greater fidelity. I'm not sure whether that was quite your question, but...
On this analysis is well placed, provided that you do the analysis at a lower in a lower resolution range.
Yes.
So by the time you go to 10 angstrom sub-nanometer resolution, you already have validated the overall aspects of your model. Maybe there are things that you can validate at higher resolution, but you could do this a priori and then go to your high resolution and collect your data the way you want. So that was a comment. So yes.
I'll tell you. I think that's that might be now separating the validation issue of what convinces somebody that a structure is correct to a certain resolution, versus what you think is the best strategy to use your dose to get the highest resolution structure.
Peter.
Hi.
So you had this point on heterogeneous data and tilt
pairs.
So now as we solve more and more structures with explained by multiple models, how do you recommend going about this? Because I guess that adds another dimension to
it. Okay. There, We could discuss it now, but there is also a slide called later called heterogeneity, and then there's also a slide where I haven't written anything down called helices. So we will hopefully chat again in about 15 or 20 minutes. Okay.
Okay.
There. Oh, sorry. Yep.
One last. Okay.
Oh yeah. Please.
Sometimes, actually, when you try to get an additional model, you end up with a partially correct model, and partially correct in the sense that because of some pseudo-symmetries, you sort of have a mirrored version in there. It seems to me that the tilt test in those cases might actually be quite misleading.
Yeah. Yes. So I think that the question of the correctness of a model is a question you would answer at a given resolution. So if you have pseudo-symmetry at some low resolution, that might very well be a good description of the system. So that's the way I would think about it. You can either prove...
No, I mean quite significant asymmetry, but still, due to the alignment and so on, you lock yourself into 50% going this way, 50% this way. It's far away from being correct, but for the tilt test, you then end up with something that looks sensible.
Yeah. Well, one thing we've observed that if the if the object doesn't have handedness, you will certainly get the different populations. But well, I think the answer is that not to dodge the question is that if you see that feature in the tilt plot, then it means that one should probably stop looking and analyze. But no, I think that's a general question about also how we validate symmetry and certainly how can we move away from our initial assumptions. Okay. Okay, so resolution measures is the FSC. There are a whole lot of other measures now. R measure, there are... We at this high resolution, we're thinking of the maps as having different resolution in different parts, and there are all sorts of ways to analyze the variance and confidence intervals of one's density, and that's I think we'll hear more about that. I wasn't going to say anything more except to say that we. Begin with a map such as this one, and there's the idea, and this comes from the validation task force that I'll mention a little bit later, is that map resolution should be reported and visual structural features should be in accordance with the claimed resolution. And one agreement is that the whole, that aside from any given cutoff, one should show the whole curve as a way of understanding where it is or is not well determined, but of course then that is a statistic that is covering the whole map, and one might also need to look at that more detail. But obviously most of the presentations here have shown high resolution where we would exceed the expected features, alpha helices, beta sheets and side chains. And I would say from what I've seen about where people looked at plots and they didn't seem to be quite, had some problems, I think we often see the problems in the maps as well. But obviously, ultimately, what we see in the map is probably is the most important thing. And we've seen even some very difficult cases, such as a smooth apoferritin having amazingly side chains. So that's an FSC curve. The there's the 0.5 criterion and the 0.143 criterion, and one of the ideas was that the that since your half map has fewer particles, it's at lower resolution. But I think in this expression that came from, I think, Nico in around 2000, that the full map, if you were comparing full maps, you would expect a higher threshold. And then ultimately, one closer to what the crystallographers use is comparing your full map against the perfect reference, and we can estimate how much higher that would be, so that for Fourier shell correlation of 0.14 based upon the half maps, one would might expect that the correlation of a full map against the perfect model would give a correlation according to this expression of 0.5. And that expression is similar to what the crystallographers call a figure of merit. We think of it as a mean phase error in the last shell of 60 degrees, and you can look up on this table and see the various what those things mean, and from phase error, signal to noise, and Fourier shell. Something which is also now being recommended in the world where there are models that fit the maps is what is the correlation between a map calculated from your model and the actual and your experimentally determined map, and that's this called CREF here, and is indeed but that the idea is from your Fourier shell correlation curve you can also calculate what you predict that to be, and in this case the dotted line is the comparison of a map against the model. So for example, this case is about between 7 and 8 angstroms probably, and the question is does that look like such a map, and the answer is no, and the problem is the fall off of the structure factor intensities in this radially averaged plot means that there is a the high resolution features are weak. Now, that is due to a combination of B factor due to image problems, and then a temperature factor due to computation. So there's obviously the work of recent years in both experiments and programs is to make that much less. But in any event, to calculate, to make sure your map looks as it should, you may need to bring up the high-resolution structure factors in a way that does not also blow up the noise. And that is called contrast restoration. So that's application of a negative temperature factor, amplifies both signal and noise, but that CREF, or perhaps some other weighting factor, is designed to suppress the noise so that that at the same time you apply the negative temperature factor, you weight down the shells that are where the data is poor. So, again, at very low resolution, the CREF is near 1. At very high resolution, it becomes a smaller quantity. The effect on the fall off of the structure factors is a depression of those high resolution ones. That linear fall off makes it easier to fit a linear temperature factor, and then, so the combination of the CREF-F and brings you up to the level of what you expect by a crystal structure or some other criterion such as Wilson statistics. Now, there's a direct relationship between this temperature factor and the number of particles you would expect to need to get to very high resolution. If your temperature factor is 1,000, it'll take you a long time to get to 4 angstroms, maybe never. And through both good images and good computations, a small temperature factor will bring you there much more quickly. And that was slightly out of order. It was the idea that by sharpening a map, you can do it in a way which expands the noise or inflates the noise or keeps it under control, and in the end get a map which seems to match the resolution given by the other statistics. Okay. So I'm just moving on to discussion of the broad outlines of resolution assessment was really a prelude to this idea of preventing and detecting overfitting. If there were a quick question or something, I suppose we could... Okay, better off to wait. So the problem of overfitting has been known in the X-ray world for a long time, that the idea that you would set aside a bit of your data which would not be fit, which would simply be used to score it. This is called the free set, and as you're driving down your R factor through refinement, you prevent overfitting by making sure that the free R factor tracks along with it. And this was a paper ages ago by Klevecht and Brunger showing for all the for a number of data sets available then for different resolutions how that community was doing in preventing overfitting in their structures. And the idea of using something like an R-free has been introduced in this field. Shake and Franck described the idea. I think Stewart and Grigoriev thought of leaving out shells. One of the simplest ways to keep a free shell is to simply only use data to some low resolution to refine orientations, and then the signal in your FSC beyond that should not have been corrupted by overfitting, and the this resolution value for high resolution for refinement is something which you might have learned, let's say, in a tilt pair analysis that that your orientations don't get any better if you include a higher resolution data. And I think this was from Shores's work showing the fact that your reported FSC between a map and the model is much higher if you're compared to the FSC between two completely independent half sets. And again, I think that was I saw in 2000 from Nico, but I guess the way it's described now is the facing challenges to execution, Texas calls its process the gold standard. So, and obviously, so the gold standard can mean something. I think as we saw the exchanges on 3DEM, it's a nice term that can also be applied to abhorrent things. But anyway, the gold standard calculation is that you completely keep the models and the maps separate. And the... one of the studies by Sheres and Chen showed that there was actually better results by comparison with the known crystal structure by keeping the maps separate and preventing overfitting. And I think one of the other important conclusions from that is that the refinement of the two independent models or frequency-limited refinement do not lead to worse orientations or resolutions. And that's that is one of the... I gather it was so important it had to be said twice. Okay. So, right. So, Okay, then very quickly on this, the again with this problem about how do you know that somebody else's structure determination has been done in this perfect way without doing it yourself, and Henderson and co-workers proposed another form of analysis called high-resolution noise substitution, where you perform the single particle EM analysis as you would like to, but then you also repeat it with images in which the phases have been randomized beyond chosen resolution, and any overfitted noise will show up as a non-zero Fourier shell correlation beyond those limits. So the genuine information at that higher resolution is the difference between that, and I think this has been shown at least once at the meeting, which is here's the case where above 10 angstroms the phases have been randomized, and compared to the FSU where that's not been the case, if it's been substituted, there's this blue region, and it means that the signal is really only this region in between given by the green curve. So the idea is that it's a way of validating the FSC against this overfitting. Another nice feature of that paper was the demonstration of something which I think everyone has talked about and is a known feature of validation, which is the problem of a tight mask in causing correlations to higher resolution, so that you can evaluate the effect of a mask using this noise substitutions. So I'm not going to say too much here because it's all sort of philosophical stuff. Now, on the subject of models, which we're going to hear more about, obviously you can validate a map at low resolution by a model if you have a structure that fits it. I think it's good to have experimentally determined the absolute hand, because one's always surprised that there's actually a much better fit when you swap the hand of a map. But we'll hear more today about how we can describe the fit between models and maps at the level of sidechains by local real space measures. But we have a whole world of X-ray analysis already, which simply apply in terms of how to weight the data and stereochemistry, etc. And don't worry about that. And that's just the Ramachandran plot to remind us of that. Okay. Challenges, heterogeneity. It's always been spoken of something as bad. Somebody at the meeting said it was good, and that's true because it means something interesting is going on to your structure. So I, from the first talk we had at the meeting, or was it the second, from John Briggs, there was the persuasive that to see things in situ, we would want to do tomography on everything. And if we could do tomography on everything, we would understand the heterogeneity of the single particles. One thing that I have wondered about at the meeting, and I'm sure, is that is it okay to present a model to the world where you've described the structure for a very small percentage of the whole data set? You know, I understand that, you know, if you only explain 5% and we don't know what the rest is, I think we understand that. I don't know if the rest of the world can understand that. What's going on with the rest of the data set? I do think tilt pairs can help on the heterogeneity question, but there will be other things. It could be a moment to comment on that or discuss. Exactly. So, yeah, anyway, that's a big subject. We can get into it on when Gabe discusses the future. Okay, not to go off into it too much, but in tomography, there are the validation questions, the resolution estimate of a tomogram. In addition to having Einstein appearing out of the noise, you imagine Einstein coming out with a wedge taken out of his brain, which doesn't sound very pretty. And so subtomogram averaging for some of the very high-resolution cases we've seen, my observation is that this keeping two separate half maps is something which is a good idea. But anyway, again, we might have discussion on that. And then helices are another type of specimen which we can go to high resolution. We can't do tilt pair analysis for low resolution. I've seen in the work of, for example, Karsten and others about keeping track of the power spectrum during iterations. As your map improves, you can also compare to the power spectrum of the individual filaments, which is not based upon their detailed alignment. So then, to summarize, map validation, we expect visibility of expected features. There's a value of these tilt pair parameter plots showing the agreement of the model with the data. Resolution validation, and that's a newer technique. We'll see whether that how widely it applied that is. But this just general idea of making sure that you can see the particles. And for this case of beta galactosidase from Chen et al., we have, most of those things are done, but we might also get an idea of, why it isn't at 1.5 angstroms based upon those plots. So I just wanted to quickly thank co-workers at two MRC institutes where I've been, and also Ardan, with whom we've been doing some work on their tilt server. And a number of the ideas expressed here have there's been written up in a document, which is this outcome of the task force on validation. And actually, Kathy Lawson was going to come up and make some comments because of there's an important role that these data banks can play in creating uniformity on these on the so and that, that's
yes so do you want to applaud Peter first? That's fine. Yeah, thank you, Peter, for just giving me a short one. Maybe you want the... Can you see the slide okay? So EM Data Bank, one of our goals is to stimulate the community to improve validation methods. And so we've done this through the VTF, and we've also done a model challenge. And in the coming year, we want to have new challenges, so I just wanted to let you guys know this. And so the goal, again, is to develop or improve, let's say, community-accepted map and model validation criteria. And the plan is that we will have two working groups, and they will be composed of 3D EM community members. And they will define the test cases and the format of each challenge. And this is as far as we've gotten with this. Is we have Bridget has agreed to be our map validation chair. Thank you, Bridget. And Paul Adams will be the model validation chair. And the remaining group membership of the groups is to be determined. But we would like for the test cases to be from deposited publicly available data. I've seen at the meeting here how helpful it has been to have publicly available raw data like the TRIP-V1. And so I would encourage everyone to consider publishing or depositing your raw data. And the formulation and announcement of these challenges will be in early 2015. If you have any comments or suggestions, I'd be happy to hear them. I have a poster, so it'll be around at 3:30, or you can also talk to Bridget. Okay, thanks.
There are a few minutes for comments and questions for Peter.
I can run the microphone if you like.
I have a question for Kathy, so you may want the mic to answer, but I'd like to know what progress has been made for the PDBE to archive and make available publicly entire data sets of movies. This was a topic almost a year ago when some of the first movies were recorded in terrific structures, and I know you were working on it, so my question is, what is the status of that?
So there is a raw data archive. Arden Pat-Bourdon has put this together at PDBE. It's called MPR. And I think even like a couple days ago, he made an announcement on the 3DM list. So it is available. You have to download some software to be able to access the data, probably also to upload it as well. But there are 15 data sets available right now.
Well, say something about the capacity of this utility. Would you please say a little more about how big the data sets can be and what the capabilities are? Not just that it's there, but some details about it.
So, as far as I'm aware, there's no limitation on the size of the data set that can be deposited. The format is whatever people want to deposit. There are particle sets. There are raw images. And I think Henning has deposited like a whole directories full of images and scripts and things like that for... So you can deposit basically what you want there.
I just recognize there are now several really nice maps out, but for example, it's a big complex and it has bound some accessory factors. And the resolution estimate of the big map is like 3 point something, very nice map. But if you download the map and look at the factors bound, they sometimes... Yeah, they really disappear. So the resolution estimate of 3 point something resolution at the periphery of a big, okay, let's call it ribosome and some bound factors is just not 3 something, but sometimes more close to 8 or 9. And the modeling is also sometimes done at, I would say, not so carefully that the resolution, like the local resolution, is really taken into care. It's maybe something for a community to say, yeah, maybe only modeling should be done at like local resolution filtered maps or something like that. And are there general tools available like doing a real good local resolution estimates? Because there are different software tools, but there are so many parameters which you can actually choose that I'm, as a newcomer to the field, actually kind of a bit confused. Which one is the best? The one which gives me the highest resolution? Or the one which is probably more true but gives me a bit less resolution? And is there any like general way in the field?
Indeed, there is, and it's shown on my poster. There are very few parameters. You will get local resolution, local filtration, local variability. So it's full package. It runs very quickly. And I'm not pushing my case, but I agree with you that indeed it should probably require the addition to what is deposited, the local resolution.
So this is something, it's just to the same extent, but I mentioned this at the previous Gordon conference. So right now we have a couple of packages that can do local resolution calculations, but we still don't have something that really does the B-factoring for the different resolutions. We have to maybe do more than one map with two different filterings, and this is, it is not ideal. Your package. Okay, we should. Right. Because I think in the case of modeling, you know, you can model the whole map, you just have to use different type of criteria when you are modeling in different areas, but it would be very good to have a map that has shows the full density with the right level of detail for all these modeling.
Of course, X-ray maps have always had good parts and bad parts, so, you know, it's both the...
Yes, heat map. Something that I also would like to mention concerning the gold standard, because you see the way gold and, you know, the word seems like this is bulletproof, this is not going to fail, and this is not just me. Sears, I don't know if he's here, but have seen him himself, he's aware. This is a readout of self-consistency. If you have, there are pathological cases that are not that rare where just given the particle shape, there is one particular angle that is poorly described, where there's smearing describing one of the in one of the directions, and this will really make your map looking pretty horrible. However, this will not be picked up because there will be consistency in the smearing, and you could have a structure that is giving you gold standard resolution of 7 angstrom where it's impossible to see alpha helices because you have something that is circularly averaged out, washed out.
Yeah, so. I think that those cases certainly exist. It's possible that applying Richard's noise substitution might be one way of assessing that.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, Paul is very eager to say something about it, maybe similar to what I wanted to say, and you've now said it as well. There are ways to cheat these measures. Tilt tests, Fourier correlation, and I just think it's dangerous to declare that these problems are solved, as some people are doing. I think this is not so, and gold standard suggests that if you do this, everything is fine. I don't like that term, to be honest. Mm. It would be great if we at least realize, fine, I mean, we need to have a term, and gold sounds nice,
Latinum.
But that this is not really solved.
I just wanted to add to what you just said, and I will take a liberty of playing shared here for a moment. So if you follow the description of RELION and how this is done, it's recognized that these are so-called local optimizers, plus the package doesn't do the initial model. So, for example, the famous MAO map was done using golden standard and passed test to whatever resolution it passed. So from this point of view, the main danger there is that if one chooses totally incorrect or even largely incorrect model, that will go through, refine, and it will look reasonably good. The ultimate tests are, of course, secondary features, but if you don't see them, then who knows?
I think it's important to distinguish with the MAO map that the gold standard could never detect the problem because the particles were picked by correlation with a reference. So all the data set of noise agreed to high resolution. The gold standard for a refinement did exactly what it should in that case.
Okay, so we're going to have more chances to talk about validation methods. Let's now thank Peter again and go have coffee.